Today's Taisho will be on case 19 in the Mumonkan, the Umenkwan, the Gate of No Barrier. Case 19 is entitled Nonsense, Ordinary Mind is the Way. Joshu asked Nansen, "What is the way?" "Ordinary mind is the way," Nansen replied. "Shall I try to seek after it?" Joshu asked. "If you try for it, you will become separated from it," responded Nansen. "How can I know the way unless I try for it?" persisted Joshu. Nansen said, "The way is not a matter of knowing or not knowing. Knowing is delusion. Not knowing is confusion. When you have really reached the true way beyond doubt, you will find it as vast and boundless as outer space. How can it be talked about on the level of right and wrong?" With these words, Joshu came to a sudden realization. Mumon's comment, Nansen, dissolved and melted away before Joshu's questions and could not offer a plausible explanation. Even though Joshu comes to a realization, he must delve into it for another 30 years before he can fully understand it. Mumon's verse, "The spring flowers, the autumn moon, summer breezes, winter snow. If useless things do not clutter your mind, you have the best days of your life." Thank you so much for coming to practice Zazen this morning on this beautiful day. Everybody was really sitting quite beautifully this morning, really wonderfully still. Excellent practice. Really an honor to practice with everybody here. This koan is really quite famous, "Ordinary Mind is the Way," and in some ways this expresses very, very clearly the teaching of Zen, and also I think the teaching of Buddhism. You know, everybody knows that the Buddha had an enlightenment experience. And this is a cliche. People have all kinds of ideas about what enlightenment really is. If you go back to the earliest sutras in Buddhism were probably the Pali Sutras. And most of the Mahayana sutras that we read in Zen, so for example the Heart Sutra or the Diamond Sutra, were actually written maybe many centuries after the Pali Sutras, which were probably written a couple centuries after the Buddha's life. So, you know, they give us a little window on Buddhism closer to the start of closer to its start, and it's possible that they are in some ways more accurate than the later sutras. So, you know, if you read the Pali Sutras, the Buddha, they talk very much about the Buddha's experience of enlightenment. Probably some of you are familiar with the details of that story. The Buddha had like a traumatic experience because he had been raised in luxury. And in the sutras, it says that he had not experienced sickness, old age, and death because his father kept him in the royal compound. And I find that a little bit hard to believe myself. I imagine that even if his father were a very powerful person, that would be hard to conceal. Those things would be hard to conceal. But the story is that he had been raised in this very protected environment, and then left the royal compound, sort of escaped to see the world. And when he went outside the royal compound, he was shocked to see somebody who was dying of who was dying of some kind of illness, very sick at any rate. And he had never, according to the legend, he had never seen somebody who was really sick like that. Maybe smallpox or something terrible like that. And then he saw a corpse, a dead person, and according to the legend, he had never seen a corpse before. And then finally he saw somebody who was really quite old, and it was shocking to him. You know, according to the legend, he didn't understand what was wrong with this person. At any rate, whether this is really like historically accurate or not, we could believe maybe that the Buddha had a traumatic recognition, right, of sickness, old age, and death as basic human conditions. And that's definitely so. You know, a friend of mine, in the prime of his life, just got a cancer diagnosis. And this person, he has remarried just recently and started his life all over again, had been rebuilding his life. He's in his 50s and, you know, had many, you know, just weeks ago told me he was at his happiest that he'd been in maybe 20 or 30 years. You know, that his partner was somebody he really loved. He felt he'd met somebody who was the love of his life. This is real. And then they had just gotten married, some routine tests at the doctor turned up cancer. So now, you know, there's this giant cloud hanging over his life, right? And something like cancer is really frightening because, you know, it's out of our control. It's just completely out of our control. You know, one of my good friends in the writing program where I work, one of our really best teachers, her name was Liz. Liz was just this incredibly vibrant person, you know. And then she had pancreatic cancer. And went on a sabbatical. And when she came back briefly before she died, she was like a skeleton, you know. So it's definitely the case I was shocked. You know, I was shocked. I was moved. You know, I was almost in tears to see somebody I have known for, you know, 30 years who was such a vibrant and wonderful, sunny person, you know, basically in this state. And it just seemed so unfair. And fortunately, she lived long enough to go to her daughter's wedding, which was really a nice way for things to work out, you know. So she saw her daughter happily off into adult life. And then she died, you know. So maybe something like this was what affected the Buddha, you know, some events like this. Maybe before then he was sort of oblivious. You know, most people who are young are fairly oblivious to these realities. You know, it seems quite impossible that one could die if you are like a healthy 17-year-old. You know, but anyway, when you're 50 or 60, a lot of your friends start disappearing or getting ill. You realize that this is, you know, our life is very contingent. In the Diamond Sutra, at the end of the Diamond Sutra, the Buddha says, you know, when you're going through your life, it seems like a long journey. But when you get to the end and you look back, it's like a finger snap. It's like a flash of lightning that illuminates the ground and then it's over. And I think that's quite true. So anyway, the Buddha had this existential or traumatic encounter with mortality. And it took all the joy out of his life. And he himself was recently married and had a little child. But, you know, knowing that there was this kind of contingency to life, that, you know, you just can't guarantee anything, just absolutely left him unable to return to his normal, you know, routines. Now, I think all of this is quite believable. Another person I know is on the faculty here at Rutgers. And she had gone through the death of her husband. And this was also like this long, drawn-out process. And she is a quite respected professor. And I had lunch with her the other day, and she said, you know, I'm leaving Rutgers. And I said, what do you mean? You know, that's incredible. What do you mean you're leaving? She said, you know, I just can't stand to go back to my classes, my classroom, my research. I just can't do that anymore. And I understand, you know, she had been taking care of her ailing husband for a number of years. It was a long, grueling process. And at the end of that process, you know, I think she was in the same state as the Buddha must have been. You know, it's just she just said nothing she does now has any meaning. It has any life to it, you know. So she's going to quit her job at Rutgers. She was lucky that her spouse had an insurance policy. So she's going to quit her fairly young in her life, and she has her savings, and she has this money from the life insurance policy. And she wants to try something totally new with her life. So I think that was what happened to the Buddha. And around this time in India, there was this explosion of interest explosion, we could say, of like questioning, you know, like who are we, where do we come from, and where are we going? You know, this became like an urgent issue at that time. And there were these ritual specialists called Brahmins. There's still Brahmins around. If you have friends who are from India and you ask them, do you know any Brahmins? They're probably from that caste themselves. These are like priests, like hereditary priesthood. And they do rituals at various moments in life. They will do, you know, do rituals. People go and ask the Brahmins to recite from the sacred texts. And they'll recite from the sacred texts. But the Buddha and many of the young people around around the Buddha at that time, there was like a movement, basically. They didn't want to listen to the Brahmins. They didn't think the Brahmins knew anything. You know, the Brahmins just went back to these old stale books, and all they could do was do rituals, and they didn't really have any insight. They just went through the empty rituals. So there was this movement in the Buddha's time. You know, why don't we decide? Why don't we find out, you know, who we are? What are we doing with our lives? You know, what does it mean to be, you know, if there is such a thing as awakening to reality, what would it mean to awaken to reality, you know? people must have understood that their way of life was artificial, you know, different people coming from different parts of India must have met each other, and they realized, oh, you do think you get married this way, we get married this way, you get married that way, you know, your house looks like this, our house looks like this. You know, there's no, what's the right way to get married? What's the right way to have a house? You know, people didn't know any longer answers to these questions. So lots of people became interested in meditation practice. And this is a very ancient part of Indian culture. You know, people had discovered long before the Buddha that by putting the body in different states, arrangements, you could change people's consciousness. You know, so Indian people discovered fairly early on that there isn't one form of consciousness, that there are many different forms of consciousness, and the meditation practice was like experimenting with consciousness. And so there were all these teachers all over India, basically experimenting, sort of like doing research into consciousness, trying to find out what was real and what was not real. And the Buddha was motivated by his sort of existential encounter with the shortness of life and the uncertainty of life to leave his home. His father was apparently a very powerful person, maybe like a tribal chief. And he went out on the road, and he joined some of these groups, basically, and he started studying with two really famous meditation teachers. And one meditation teacher taught him how to enter emptiness, which we do ourselves still, right, on the cushion. We call it, in Zen we call it mu shin. In Sanskrit it's called shunyata, zeroness, nothingness. So, you know, the Buddha started studying with his first teacher, and the teacher showed him how to enter nothingness. And then he studied with another teacher who showed him another aspect of, you could say, nothingness. And in both cases, the Buddha was a very good student. You know, he was an exceptionally intelligent person, capable of great determined effort. And in both cases, the teachers offered him the chance to be their second in command. But the Buddha wasn't happy with nothingness. You know, he thought maybe it might be valuable, but he didn't think it was enlightenment. And so he left both of these teachers and he went off on his own. And as I said, there were these groups of people practicing meditation together and exploring consciousness. And so, you know, the Buddha joined up with five people who were doing this sort of like research on consciousness. And nobody knew quite what to do. You know, people would meditate for hours. According to some records, you know, they would try things like hanging upside down. You know, modern yoga hadn't really been developed yet, but some of those postures were already being practiced. I read in one book that actually some people actually suspended themselves over fire. You know, I don't think they were actually cooking themselves, but it couldn't have been very comfortable. You know? And lots of people tried fasting, which is a practice the world over, right? You know, fasting is a way of altering your consciousness, right? In the Buddhist group, they decided to try fasting, and the Buddha really almost died, right? You know, he realized that he was going to die if he didn't eat something soon. And he also realized, you know, this is crazy. You know, if you read the sutras, he actually almost says, this is crazy. He says, you know, I've done all of these austerities and I'm no closer to enlightenment than before. You know, so he broke away from his five companions and he went into a village where there was like a little farming village. And a little girl saw him and he looked so wretchedly emaciated that she was alarmed and she brought him some rice and some milk. And he ate the rice and the milk, and when he did this, it was like energy flowed through his body, you know. And he profusely thanked the little girl, and he went back to meditate on his own. And then we're told that the Buddha sat down again and began to meditate. And the sutras actually tell us that he went through a series of different states of consciousness. So, you know, he sat down on the cushion and he basically found a quiet place to practice and began to enjoy sitting in the quiet, maybe listening to the breeze. And then he started watching his breath, and his thought process stopped. But his sensory awareness was still alive, right? This happens to us on the cushion. We sit down on the cushion, and if you watch your breath, you begin to notice that your thoughts become fewer and fewer. And then, basically, if you continue to watch the breath, your thoughts will get farther and farther away, and they might not stop altogether. But at some point, you will enter a state where your mind is very blank, you know. This is emptiness, shunyata. And sometimes it's easier to get to that state if you follow the breath out to the end, and then you just look at the end of the breath. You'll notice that when you look at that place, your mind is really quite dark or quite blank. And the Buddha got to that place, and then he got to a place where time just seemed to disappear. Which, if you practice for a few years, you've had that experience. You know, you'll sit down on the cushion sometime, and if you're not in the mood, you know, half an hour can seem like an eternity. And if you're in the groove, you know, you sit down on the cushion and, you know, half an hour goes like that. It's like, what was that? How long was that? You know, so, and then finally the Buddha reached a place where you could say time disappeared, and then like he felt like space had disappeared, just like this infinite space opening up in all directions around him. And you've probably had that experience, you know, where you feel boundless around you. One of my teachers used to make us imagine our breath going off into space with no limitations, and that definitely is a very good strategy. So, you know, the Buddha just got to that place, and then those stages, there were four stages according to the sutras, and then there are four stages which are called, these stages are called jhanas, and then there were four formless jhanas, you know. And you know, when you are meditating very deeply, it may not be exactly like this, you know, it may not be exactly methodical, like where you step one, stage two, stage three, stage four. And when you're in deep mushin, you may not realize, oh, I'm in the third formless jhana, or oh, I'm in the second of the formless jhanas. It just seems like everything disappears and you're in kind of this formless place a lot of the time, or your mind is blank and dark. And it's not continuous. You know, we go into one state and we come out, we go into another state and we come out. So the story is a little bit idealized. It's sort of it's a teaching tool, and it's trying to lay out all the different stages of consciousness. And the Buddha finally got to a place where, you know, there's really no even awareness of awareness. And if you've been meditating for a while, you've definitely been in that place. You've definitely been in that place. You weren't aware because you didn't have awareness of awareness, but there is such a state. It's a very subtle state, and if you've gone to, say, a sesshin, I'm confident you've been in that state. You know, sometimes when people are at Zacheen and they come in and they have a meal, you know, you sit down and you look at your rice and there isn't literally a thought in your head, you know. And in the West, we think of that as very stupid, but actually that's a very advanced state of awareness. That's very close to the awareness of no awareness state. So even though it seems ordinary, it's actually a very advanced state of concentration that takes many years to achieve, or at least a lot of practice to achieve. So the Buddha finally reached this state where there was no form, and no, basically you could say the mind just came to an absolute stop. The sutra is a little vague about what happens next. The great Japanese master Dogen says that the Buddha had his enlightenment when he was in this absolutely formless state and then noticed overhead the morning star. And then basically he had his great awakening experience. And that is the story of the Buddha's enlightenment. And then when he had this experience, it actually lasted for many days, according to the sutras. And this is quite common, you know. When people have a Daikensho experience, it's not over in an hour. It usually goes on for a number of days. It begins to, your consciousness sort of returns to a little to more like your everyday consciousness, but usually this can last, four or five days, a week. After this was over, according to the legend, the Buddha said, "You know, that's amazing. Nobody would believe me if I tried to tell them about this." And according to the legend, heavenly being appeared to the Buddha and said, you know, don't think that way. There's a lot of suffering people in the world who will be liberated if you just tell them about this experience. And so the Buddha said, okay, I will try to tell them. So he went back to see his five companions, and they were all mad at him because he had he'd eaten. You know, they were still starving. And he came back with a big smile on his face, looking very refreshed. And they, "You traitor, you've obviously been eating." And he says, "You won't believe what's just happened to me, but I've broken through." And at first they were very skeptical, but then, you know, they were quite impressed by the transformation. And that's the beginning of the Buddha's teaching career. When this all happened to the Buddha, he went out and he taught, trying to help people reach this same experience. And this experience is the core of Buddhism. You know, you definitely should read the sutras. But the core of Buddhism is having this experience. Early Buddhists especially, interpreted the Buddha's experience in terms of what they, sort of like what they all already believed about reality and so on. So, you know, it's probably the case that early Buddhists understood the Buddha's enlightenment as, kind of like a transcendent experience that was very far removed from ordinary human beings, right? It's possible they thought of it this way. You know, they might have, or over time at any rate, the Buddhist understanding of enlightenment became more and more remote, more and more inaccessible. People put it on this giant pedestal. And in some places, like Sri Lanka, people actually stopped trying to have enlightenment experiences because they thought, you know, only very special beings can have those kinds of experiences. You know, But, you know, actually, you know, Zen represents or comes out of a moment in a Buddhist tradition where people were doing a lot of meditation and having these experiences. And they said, you know, these aren't really inaccessible to human beings, that people can do this. And enlightenment is not this extraordinarily remote and distant attainment. You know, it's not a state of mind you achieve. It's actually already at the core of your consciousness. It's already at the core of your mind. So you know, we all have a tendency, I think, to imagine, you know, enlightenment as something unattainable and very remote from us, like transcendent. So you know, especially people from like a Western religious tradition, when they think of you know, Buddha, they also think maybe of somebody like Jesus. You know, who is a divine being, divine, like a uniquely divine being. But you know, early Buddhists may have thought that way too about the Buddha. But you know, the Zen school, lots of people in the Buddhist world didn't reach that conclusion. You know, they reached the conclusion that enlightenment is really, if it's really that remote, you know. Forget it, you know. Why even bother to practice, right? But the conclusion that Zen people reached was the opposite, that, you know, you are always already enlightened. If you weren't, no amount of meditation or fasting or anything else you do could get you any closer to that state. And so, you know, there was a real kind of revolution in practice. Instead of seeing this as very remote, people developed a different style of practice. Yes, you know, you have to do a lot of meditation. But the reason you have to do a lot of meditation is because you don't trust yourself. You know, it's pretty hard for most people to believe that they are fundamentally enlightened, or even fundamentally good. You know, we all develop mental habits in our lives that convince us that we're not good. You know, just the other day I was thinking about something terrible I did to my brother when we were kids. I was going through some photographs and I found a picture of my brother who died about 10 years ago from cancer. And I was reminiscing about our childhood, and then I realized I actually shot my brother with a BB gun. And I couldn't believe it. I thought, I can't believe I shot my own brother with a BB gun. I mean, what a bastard I was, you know. What was wrong with me? You know? And I was really ashamed, you know. We all have things like that, you know. We all go through life and we acquire, we make mistakes. You know, we're not always kind. You know, sometimes we're really angry and selfish. And this convinces us over time that we're probably not Buddha material. We form a self-image that seems very far from enlightened. And when we try, you know, we might try to escape from that negative self-image by imagining that we are a Buddha. You know, okay, I am a Buddha, you know, very special person. And that doesn't help either. In fact, it makes things worse, right? You will definitely meet all kinds of, in the world of like spiritual practice, if you look hard, you'll find all kinds of people who are deceivers and imposters. I remember when I was practicing at the Seattle Zen Center, there was a guru in Oregon whose name was Rajneesh, Rajneesh was his name. And Rajneesh had been a professor, I believe he had been a philosophy professor in India. And he gradually transformed himself into a guru. And Rajneesh and his followers eventually were embroiled in scandals in India. And they bought some land in eastern Oregon and tried to set up like their own little county in Oregon. And basically, Rajneesh liked to have his followers buy Rolls Royces for him. And every time he would go out in one of his Rolls Royces, all his followers would line up along the road with their palms together to honor him. And they all worked very hard for him so he could live the life of a multimillionaire. And all of this fell apart when actually Rajneesh's second in command tried to kill some legislator in the Oregon state legislature. So, you know, basically she was indicted and sent to prison, and there were just all these terrible stories. You know, the funny thing is, if you read Rajneesh's books, they're very good, you know. They're really great. He's a very good writer. He's quite an intelligent man. And he's read everything. He's read all the Zen and Buddhist classics, Hindu classics, Sufism. And he's able to combine all this very convincingly. And I really think Rajneesh thought he was sort of a divine being. I really do think so. But I definitely don't think he was awake. So we all form these images of ourselves as quite far from enlightenment. And we do things that are really lousy. You know, we yell at our dog that we love. You know, we do lousy things, you know. I myself, one time I pushed my cat out the window. I was in graduate school and I was under a lot of pressure. And I pushed him out the window. He was okay, but I could have killed him, you know. And I loved my cat. You know, I loved him. Why did I do that? You know, obviously not Buddha material, right? And I really did that. And to this day it fills me with shame that I did such a thing to my beloved cat, you know. You know, so we definitely form these images of ourselves that are very negative. And then, you know, if we try to, we try to create sort of like a fantasy that we're going to live out of ourselves as serene and enlightened beings, that's even like worse, right? And that's very widespread in the world of like spiritual practice, right? Incredibly widespread. You know, so it's like a mutual delusion society where the teacher is deluded and the student is deluded. You know, and you see that everywhere. But, you know, if you sit down on the cushion and you, trust the process, you know, if you come in to sit and you have expectations, that's not going to work, you know. You just have to sit down on the cushion and watch your breath and see what happens. And, you know, on some sits, not much might happen. But, you know, if you come back and you try it again, you know, eventually you're going to have a sit where you really go into deep mushin, deep shunyata. And, you know, please notice that, you know, all you had to do was show up and watch your breath with some self-control. Right? It's like you have to show up, but beyond that, you can't make it happen. You know, if you come and sit down on the cushion and you say, damn it, I'm going to get into mushin, you're probably going to have a terribly frustrating sit, you know. You have to try, but let go. It's like you have to present yourself. If you sleep in, and you don't come to the sit, nothing happens. You can dream of being enlightened, but when you wake up, nothing has changed, right? But when you come to the sit, you sit down on the cushion, and you watch the breath, and then you just let what is happening happen. And this is a different style of practice. You know, early Buddhists, I think, didn't understand practice this way. They thought of it as very methodical, like a science. You know, you do this, then you do this, then you do this, and very much something you control and make happen. And they thought of enlightenment as very remote, very difficult, like physics, right? But, you know, the Zen view is, you know, that's quite mistaken. You know, don't practice that way. It just screws things up. If you don't practice, nothing happens. But when you practice with a trusting mind, all kinds of amazing things happen. You know, you inside you, there's a Buddha mind trying to get out. And, you know, if the more you try to control the situation, the less likely it is to begin to manifest itself. So your job is to present yourself and then sort of just let things happen. And, you know, you come in one day and you sit down on the cushion and it's like heaven. It's like, wow, where did that come from? See? And you know, if you're trying to find Mushin and you haven't been able to reach that state, you know, you can't make it happen. You just have to sit, watch your breath, and one day you're going to notice your mind is absolutely blank. And if you're working on your koan, you know, the more you try to answer your koan, the worse it gets. I'm sure you know this from experience. If you say, okay, you know, I've gone to 3 sessions and I still haven't answered my koan, this time I must answer it. Right, you're dooming yourself. Right, you should just say, "Listen, you know, I practice Zen because it's what I want to do. Something in me makes me practice Zen, and I'm going to listen to that voice. And I may never answer this koan in 10 years. I don't care. I'm being true to my true nature." And if you practice that way, all kinds of wonderful things will happen to you. In fact, if you live that way, all kinds of wonderful things will happen to you. So you know, ordinary mind is not the mind that, you know, we do have a kind of ordinary mind that, you know, is worried about whether you're going to get a promotion or not, or whether, you know, how am I going to send that kid to college, right? And, you know, everybody has those worries, right? How, you know, what might my, you know... property taxes have gone up again in New Jersey, you know. So yes, and you lie in bed thinking, well, that's outrageous, you know, what'll, you know, okay. But, you know, there's another part of your mind, which is this trusting mind. And you can't worry about, there's no timetable for your awakening. You know, you will also meet people in the world of spiritual practice who will tell you, oh, I had my Dai Kensho, you know, when I was 30 years old, just like the Buddha, you know. Just ignore such people. You know, they might have had Dai Kensho, but they haven't learned anything from it, you know. The greatest Zen master of the last maybe 300 years was a Chinese man named Xu, whose Dharma name was Xu Yun, Empty Cloud. And Empty Cloud was an interesting guy. You know, his father didn't particularly like Buddhism. His father was a wealthy, you could say, like a wealthy landowner. And he wanted his son to step in and be a wealthy landowner. But Xu Yun, even as a boy, was fascinated by Buddhism and really wanted to practice the Great Way. So his father was so worried about this that he married Xu Yun when he was like 17 years old. And as luck would have it, Xu Yun's wife also had these interests. And so they made a deal. They said, look, you know, we're trapped, you know. Our parents have married us and we have to live this way. But, you know, let's pretend to be married. And when our parents pass away, or when we can get free from them, let's follow the Great Way. So they actually did. They decided not to have children, and Xu Yun's father died shortly after that. And he became a monk, and she became a nun. And Xu Yun was ordained, I think, when he was 19 years old. And his ex-wife was also ordained and became very famous Zen master also. So anyway, Xu Yun did not have his great awakening experience until he was like 58. So that's 40 years, right? When I hear, you know, I do meet people who actually had, they don't quite say this, but they strongly imply it, right? I've been practicing Zen for 8 years and no enlightenment. I'm out of here, right? That's not a good spirit, I would say, you know. But, you know, Xu Yun patiently trusted the process. He trusted ordinary mind for 40 years. You know, and at the end of it, he had a great awakening experience when he was 58, and he became the foremost. You know, people who met Xu Yun said it was like meeting Joshu. You know, they said it was like meeting the great Zen masters of the Tang Dynasty. He was a totally real person. You know, he was totally unpretentious. He was totally present. And, you know, I think he was that way because he had this trusting mind. You know, present yourself, do your best, and then trust the process. It's not just about Zen, it's about who you are and how you live. You know, you can't stop one hair on your head from turning white or falling out, you know. So why are you worried, right? I'm sure Xu Yun had his moments of doubt where he said, you know, I've been practicing for 40 years and I have not had Daikensho. But, you know, he did the right thing. He simply sat on the cushion. He watched his breath. He entered Mushin. He helped others. He got up. He ate his rice. He went about his duties. And one day, everything came together for him. So, you know, we all have this tendency to imagine, you know, especially Americans, right? We're very goal-oriented. We're big planners. We believe in having a life plan and so on. You know, I can't imagine myself, personally, anything more ridiculous, right? I mean, I have two good friends who could have had life plans, but those plans are in the trash because life had other plans for them. You know, so we can't control anything, but we can be open to everything. And that's Zen, that's Buddhism. Right? So, don't count the days that you're working on your koan. Trust yourself. You know, the reason we count the days is because we don't trust. We don't believe, you know, somewhere inside ourselves we say, it's impossible that I could be an enlightened being. And that's actually, having that doubt is probably a good thing, in a way. So we all need to sit on the cushion. We all need to be frustrated. We all need to be blocked. And we all go back to the breath, and then the doors open up inside us for reasons we don't fully understand. But inside every one of us, there is an enlightened mind trying to get out. So please, you know, everybody here came to practice today. Please continue to practice. Joshu asked Nansen, what is the way? What is the great way? Nansen replied, your ordinary mind is the great way. Joshu said, well, should I try to reach it? If you try for it, you will become separated from it. You're not trusting, responded Nansen. How can I know the way unless I try for it, persisted Joshu. Nansen said, the way is not a matter of knowing or not knowing. Life is really not about meaning, believe it or not. We say life is meaningless. Life is really about connecting, being fully present with the moment. And Nansen said, the way is not a matter of knowing or not knowing. Knowing is delusion. It's just a fantasy. Not knowing is confusion. When you have really reached the true way beyond a doubt, you will find it is vast and boundless as outer space. How can it be talked about on the level of right and wrong? With those words, Joshu came to, he had an awakening. Wuon's comment, Nansen dissolved and melted away before Joshu's questions and could not offer a plausible explanation. Even though Joshu comes to a realization, he must delve into it for another 30 years before he can fully understand it. Wuon's verse, the spring flowers, the autumn moon, summer breezes, winter snow. If useless things do not clutter your mind, you have the best days of your life.